Ho Chi Minh on 19th March 74 in Charlottesville.
So, you were in the very earliest part of the group that Bach...
No, I was initially in the physics department.
I see.
For 1 year. I took my master's, and then that summer I went to the astronomy department. Fred Whipple was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been always interested in astronomy. And particularly radio astronomy towards the last years of stay in India, I was interested in radio astronomy and had some correspondence with radio astronomers of that period.
But there was no radio astronomy research in India?
No, not at that time. It was at that time, just before I left, a year before I left, Taffy Bowen from Australia had visited India for some scientific meeting.
Mm-hmm.
He gave a few lectures on radio astronomy as it existed at that time.
I see.
Which was mostly solar radio astronomy.
And that got you interested?
Yeah, it got me interested. So, just about the same time, I'd applied to Harvard, and also I got a fellowship to go to Australia to do radio astronomy work. I mean, Taffy Bowen arranged it. But since I got the fellowship also at Harvard, I decided to come there. But I got the fellowship at Harvard to do applied physics or physics. But the first opportunity I got, I talked to Fred Whipple. And since Whipple found out I was interested also in radio astronomy, he asked me to talk to about Bach. I went and talked to him, and of course he was, as usual, very enthusiastic self. And he said yes, there were opportunities to do radio astronomy. It was just getting started.
When was this now?
This was in the 53 summer. Already the project had started. The telescope, the 24-foot had been erected, even though it was not in operation.
Right.
And the receiver was just being completed. And so I was taken to AGC station by one of the technicians at that time. And I met Heeshan and Lily were the only two in the project. But they were doing more or less technical things, very technical in the sense of honing the gears and things like that. So, because it was essentially a local project, and there wasn't much of any financial support.
But the dish itself must have been bought somewhere.
Yes, at that time, when they first wanted to build the dish, I understand that they looked around and there was no one really interested in building dishes, particularly when they heard to be equatorially mounted. The people, radar people, they just were not used to that.
Right.
But there was one engineer who used to work for a company called D.S. Kennedy.
Right.
And Bob Grenzbach was the engineer. He designed the equatorial mount on his own, on a personal basis he designed. And Kennedy, of course, supplied some of the components for the dish. It was a very simple-minded system. The drive system was a rack and pinion arrangement.
And so it actually was put together right there, and
yes.
By the company.
No, it was not by the company. It was UN was the co-director of the radio astronomy project, and Tom Matthews was also there, but he was not as active. He was just starting to get interested. He was doing some optical work, and he was just getting interested. And so I joined in 53 as a graduate student. And of course, the first year of the graduate student, you do mostly all the coursework. So I didn't really have very much to do with the radio astronomy group, except in terms of reading.
Right.
But in 54 summer, I moved to AGC station. So by that time, the receiver had started working, and Lily and Heeshan, they had started observing. Their observing programs had started, and I got involved a little bit. The electronics there, mostly to learn.
Right.
Even though the receiver had been built, only people who knew anything about it were people who built it. So for the other people to use it later on, I had to make up a manual.
This was UN's receiver.
Yes, UN designed it. It's a very clever receiver, but it was not a very practical one for other people to use until they learn how to use it.
Did it have innovations?
The basic innovation was, I think it is still basic, it was a DC comparison.
Yes, I remember a paper on that now.
Yes, you see, the idea of the DC comparison system was published by a physicist at Harvard, one Walter Selloff. He's a nuclear physicist. He's at University of Pennsylvania now. He got the idea in connection with something else, I suppose. But he published it. And Yuen, of course, was in the physics department at that time, as a graduate student of that period. So he adapted it to the line receiver, and it was really, and it was a scanning receiver. And the one major innovation for radio line receiver system at that time was it had variable bandwidths.
I see.
And you could use 5 kc or 15 kc or 35 kc.
What kind of filter was it then?
Well, these were very ordinary RC filters. I
mean, you were switching between filters. It wasn't...
It was a single filter. You scan the local oscillator. It took 1 hour to get a profile.
Right.
You scan the local oscillator with a wide band, 5 megahertz, one band, and a narrow band, the switching between the two.
Right.
And the difference was recorded.
Right.
Which was... it took... it was one filter.
And how did you get variable resolution?
Well, that
according to the integration time, you mean?
No, that one was the fixed was the 5 megahertz bandwidth, which is essentially the IF bandwidth, total bandwidth. The other one could be either a 5 kc filter, or a 15 kc filter, or a 35.
I see.
And see, at that time, the only other people doing any hydrogen line work was the Dutch. And they were using 35 kc, and they thought there is no need, theoretically, there was no reason for using a 5 kc, and they made fun of UN, as a matter of fact. You will find in one of the, there was a conference on radio astronomy conducted by DTM, I think it was in 54.
Right, yes, I know what you mean.
In that there was an exchange. Where when Yuen described the receiver and said that he is going to use 5 kc filter, Van der Hals made fun of him, saying that we know from optical observations that the random velocities of interstellar clouds are about 7 kilometers, so there is no need to go to 5 kc.
Right.
And of course 5 kc was very important.
But now the original discovery of the hydrogen line with Yuen's receiver, or an earlier receiver, that was not a DC comparison, was it?
No. Actually, that was a very simple-minded radiometer.
And something you slapped together.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
No, that was not a DC comparison system.
Well, what was the first... what was the atmosphere of this group at the time? I mean, was it sort of an exciting time, or...?
Yes, because each... whatever was being observed was essentially new. And there wasn't that much of exchange of information with the Dutch at that time, so we didn't really know what they were doing, other than the fact that they were doing large-scale surveys.
Right.
So anything which was observed was new. And of course, since the people there had more optical background, particularly Bart and the students too, Ishan and Lily and Tom Matthews and others had optical background, the problems they decided that in a situation like the station and with the students having to do their thesis, you can't undertake long-range surveys like the Dutch. So the problems had to be restricted to more specific problems.
Of course, the Dutch did it with students too. They just take 10 years to get their degree.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it is a different system.
Right.
And so here, the optical background of the students sort of controlled the type of problems they were going to do. And Hishan's discovery was something very new, unexpected. I mean, he observed that dark, self-absorbing cloud towards the galactic center.
Right.
And Lily's work essentially was an outgrowth of the interest at that time, because Spitzer had published a series of papers on the temperature of the interstellar medium, H1 and H2 region, difference in temperatures, and cooling, heating mechanisms and all that. So there was a lot of interest as to what the dust would do to the interstellar medium. And so Bob, of course, had a lot of experience in star counts, and he had done a lot of stellar work on distribution of absorbing clouds.
Right.
So these two sort of synthesized together, and Lindy's thesis was on the gas-to-dust ratio.
Right. Had Bach worked on galactic structure at that time?
Yes. He had published during the during the 40s and very early 50s, he had published a lot of galactic structure papers.
Yeah. Why didn't he get some projects going along that line?
Well, you see, the galactic structure in the sense of spiral structure was spiral structure was essentially confirmed in 1951.
Right.
Now,
optically.
And it was known that the Dutch were doing a large scale survey. So, they had a bigger dish. So, there was no incentive to do any large scale survey in that sense.
I see. You left that to them essentially.
Yeah, in a sense.
Concentrated on special regions.
Yes. And as I said, it was the fact that by the time the telescope got into operation, both Heeshan and Lilly had been there for approximately 3 years as graduate students, and they were interested in finishing up their thesis.
Right.
So that, to some extent, dictated the type of programs undertaken also.
So what did you get involved in?
Well, one day, Bach was writing up the proposal to NSF. NSF had just started giving out small amounts of money to astronomy at that time, and he was writing up the proposal for grant for the next year. Mm-hmm. So he called me one day. This was in my early in my second year. He called me and said that you should start thinking about your thesis and write out a program so that I can include it in the NSF proposal. So at that time I had written a paper on expanding associations. You see, at that time that was the big thing in optical astronomy, as well as the concept of stellar associations by Ambatsumian was put forward in 52, 53, 54. During that period, the instability of stellar associations and the ONB associations was right. The big concept, new concept, which was introduced at that time.
You mean previous to that, all stellar clusters were thought to be bound?
Yes, and the concept that the ONB associations are have a shorter time scale and are unstable phenomena. That was a concept which was introduced by Ambatsumian. And so Blau and Morgan had measured these proper motions and shown in some cases at that published at that time that some of these stellar associations were expanding.
Right.
I think they had shown in Lacerta and Auriga that some of the associations were shown to be expanding. Perseus. So I had written a paper on these concepts at that time. Because these became available in form of translations of the Russian literature, which was still not generally available. So I had surveyed the literature and written a paper. So
was it known at that time how young O stars are?
Yes.
Theoretical,
Ambatsumian had showed that the ages of these associations could not be more than a few million years.
No, but I mean from the O star itself, the stellar evolution.
Yes, that was known. But the associations as a group are young objects, he had shown, and these optical measurements, proper motion measurements, had also indicated expansion ages of the order of a few million years. So I thought it would be very interesting to see whether, along with the expanding stars, whether the gas in these regions also was involved in the expansion phenomenon. And looking at the various associations which had been suggested, the one which would be the most interesting to study because of less complication from the galactic background, 21 centimeter radiation, was the Orion association. It's off the plane at that latitude, it's less complex. So I decided that I would look at the 21 centimeter distribution and the Orion association.
Right, and so when did you start observations?
I started observations in 55, and I actually finished the observations. It was a grid of points, some 100 different profiles obtained, and I finished the observing fairly rapidly because there was not, at the time I started observing, the only other person who was also observing for thesis was Tom Matthews.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little later, many others came into the picture observing also. So I finished observing before the end of 55. Mm-hmm. Actually, I actually completed the thesis, writing and all that in 55 itself. But Bach said to wait, and there is no great hurry in submitting the thesis. And I submitted in 56, because I was staying at Agassiz Station at that time. And we had only one technician. And Heeshan and Dilly both, when they finished their thesis in 55, they left. I was reduced manpower, so I was sort of technician.
Chief labor.
And there are a number of new graduate students by that time. Drake, Campbell Wade was of course there, and Campbell Wade had a rather important part in starting the radio astronomy program.
Yes, I want to talk to him. I haven't talked to him.
So Campbell.
What do you see as the main result of your thesis work?
I think I showed definitely that in the regions of the stellar associations, particularly in the Orion case, the gas motions have been very much influenced by the process of star formation. And it was, I interpreted the results at that time as a rather expanding ring, or expanding the sphere of gas. And by and large, it is still true, even though it's more complex. The motions are probably more complex than this simple-minded affair. But there is a very definite effect on the motions in the neighborhood
in the neutral gas
because of the formation of the association. And I think I also showed at that time one of the theories which was prevalent was that the associations were formed in the H2 region surrounding an initial H2 region.
I see.
I mean, Oort had put forward the idea that if an O star is formed and an H2 region is formed surrounding it, there is a compressed neutral region formed in the boundary, and an association is formed within that. And I tried to show from my results that this is not necessarily the sequence in associations, because here there was an expanding cloud of gas, a neutral gas, outside the association.
Right. Let me ask about the relationship between this radio astronomy group and the Harvard Department of Astronomy. Were you looked upon as sort of a bunch of wild ones, or some, or strange ones anyway?
Well, I think it varied greatly. You see, the students of that period in the Harvard Astronomy Department, they were a very homogeneous group in the sense that there was a tremendous amount of camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there at nights, very late at nights, and independent of whether you were in radio astronomy project or in other projects, students formed a homogeneous whole. And I think the students of that period got a much wider background of learning because of this interaction.
Right.
Independent of what field they were in, there were some who were working in solar field, particularly the unmarried ones of that period. They interacted a great deal. And so, no distinction was made as far as the students were concerned. But of course, the department had a lot of internal politics, which the students didn't really get involved in. We were more or less left out of it. But we could see it only at a distance. And there were indirect effects on students, because you didn't want to get any of the faculty mad at you because you are in one project, and because some of the higher-ups were...
You're implying that some of the faculty didn't think it was worth the money, or...?
No, I don't think so. I think there was one group faculty. I mean, there were three groups, research groups in the Harvard Department at that time, the Solar Research Group. Then there is the meteor.
These are led by
Menzel.
Right.
Then there is the meteor, comet, the sort of problems, solar system type of problems, led by the Whipple.
Right.
Then there is the theoretical group, theoretical group of the mostly younger people at that time, Dave Leiser and Max Krug, like that, there were some of the younger people. Then, of course, the radio astronomy group. There wasn't any active optical group. I mean, Mrs. Kopashkin was there, but she had just her own personal project, but there was no very large stellar astronomy group.
So how did they view you? Was it legitimate astronomy that you were doing?
Yes. I mean, see, we interacted with the younger theoretical group very well. I mean, for example, my thesis, I was very happy to find that was read by most members of the faculty, independent of what field they were in. I know Whipple read cover to cover. I know Menzel read cover to cover. I know the theoreticians read cover to cover and asked questions. And so I don't think there was, it was considered quite legitimate. But with regard to the future of radio astronomy, there were conflicting views. I mean, I don't think all of them realized that radio astronomy would bring in such a tremendous wealth of information. Bach probably told you about the letter he had from Walter Bade, in which I think Bade told Bach, "Oi Bach, at this age, we are entering into this field, whatever there is to be done in radio astronomy has been done by the Dutch."
Right.
And I had a copy of that letter.
Oh, you do? So what did you do after you got your degree?
Well, when I finished my degree, just about that time, AUI started thinking, actually 1955, AUI first started thinking, the Harvard group first started thinking of a larger radio telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And it was realized that a single university might not be able to afford a large instrument. And this is something bigger than a 60-foot, which Harvard had already had money for in 55. So they brought in some people from MIT, Jerry Wiesner, Ed Purcell was built, and they had a meeting to discuss about possible national observatory. And I didn't think in terms of a national observatory, but a larger organization. And the AUI was already in existence at that time. And anyway, to make a long story short, Heeshan, who was at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, he left there and he came to Harvard in 55. He left in 54 and came back in 55 as an Agassiz radio astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 56, he resigned to join the AUI.
I see.
So I took over Heeshan's position as the Agassiz radio astronomer. Agassiz radio astronomer, I took it up in 56, and in 57 Bart Bach left for Australia, so I became the director of the radio astronomy project, but I stayed for another year, but there were lots of personal reasons. At that time, the radio astronomy project at Harvard did not have the type of support which would have been necessary. That is, radio astronomy was considered by and large a purely technical project.
Mm-hmm.
The astronomy part was not well recognized by the other members of the faculty. So when I asked for greater technical support, saying that I personally am not an electronic engineer, I personally cannot keep up with the advances in electronics to build good instrumentation, that you need a good engineer.
Right.
There was no engineer, you see, at that time. I was doing everything.
Ewan had left, yeah.
Oh, Ewan was nominally there, but Ewan never spent any time on the project. I mean, he was nominally there and to give advice if you asked for it. But as far as running the project is concerned, he was never there for that. I mean, he had his own major business activity.
Mm.
So but Menzel and Whipple did not understand that you need fairly sophisticated instrumentation, and for that you need engineering staff. And I asked for the engineering staff, saying that you need one or two positions, an engineer and a technician like that. And that they were not willing to give, and Tommy Gold had joined after Bach left. Tommy Gold has even less of an appreciation of what type of expertise is needed to build and run an observatory.
He was in the astronomy department.
He was in the astronomy department. I was put in a very peculiar situation of, as far as NSF was concerned, I was the director of the radio astronomy project. Money came in my name. But since I was not a member of the observatory council, Tommy Gold was to represent the interests of the radio astronomy group in the council. And since we didn't agree on basic policies, I had the responsibility but no authority. And he had the authority but no responsibility. So I decided it is not a very congenial situation, so I resigned.
Did Bach, what was it, what were his motives for leaving? You just decided that was enough radio astronomy? Or?
No, I think it was to do with much deeper problems in the department. It's, when he came back from in South Africa in 1951, after spending a year on sabbatical there, he realized that the optical astronomy or stellar or galactic astronomy was not getting the type of support from the General Observatory Council as he wanted it. And there were, I can't really say about the personal relationship of the members of the council, but that had a lot to do with his.
But he stayed for 5 or 6 years. I mean, he was still willing to.
Yes, he tried his very best.
He finally just gave up.
I think he gave up because it was not a very smooth. You can put up a brave front only so long. And he, of course, as an optical astronomer, he had a great love for the Southern Hemisphere. And when this directorship of the major observatory in the South was offered, he thought it was a great opportunity to. His first love is the Southern Hemisphere.
And optical astronomy.
Optical astronomy. And he had already a good working relationship with Joe Posse, CSIRO.
So he was still thinking of keeping working with
radio astronomy. Yes. He wanted that relationship. And as a matter of fact, several of the radio astronomers at CSIRO now, they did the thesis at the Australian National University. John Whiteoak, Matthewson.
And Ron Akers.
Ron Akers, I mean later on, Ron Akers.
Later,
But several of them, during the time he was there, they did their work on Stromberg.
So where did you go after Harvard?
After Harvard, I was for a short time at the University of Pennsylvania because they thought they would be interested in starting a radio astronomy program or at least having a close cooperation with Green Bank when it got started. But Green Bank did not have any instrument then yet. First instrument came only in 59.
Right.
So I did come a few times from Pennsylvania to Green Bank. But I finally decided being at Green Bank is much preferable than Philadelphia. I did not like the city at that time. So I moved to Green Bank.
In 59?
59.
And then what did you do there?
Well, 59, once I moved to Green Bank, the only instrument which was in existence at that time was the 85-foot, the first 85. And I got interested in H2 regions because the 3.75 centimeter receiver with that 3 minute of arc resolution made it possible to look at H2 regions. And I thought a density distribution, electron density distribution in H2 regions would be a rather important thing because there were many, many unknown things about H2 regions at that time. So I decided to work on a number of H2 regions, but particularly the extreme cases, the highly condensed ones, as well as the ones with very low central condensation, as the Orion Nebula and the Rosette. And that kept me for quite a few years and until the 300-foot came along.
What was it like in those early days at Green Bank? What was the atmosphere?
Well, the atmosphere there was, again, there were lots of growing pains because it was not, there was no direction, the authority of the state in New York, the AUI officers ran. There was no the local director, and Dave Heeshan, being the senior most person, he was in a very difficult position because he had more or less the responsibility to get any science out of the place. But all the major decisions were being made by people far away, and whom he really did not know too well personally. I mean, they were not astronomers, because the initial AUI board of trustees did not have any astronomers. And it was a rather difficult period in that sense.
And he wasn't officially a director, is that right?
No, he was not director. He was just an astronomer like others, except for the fact that he was the first one to go there. So it was a very ambiguous situation. But those who were there, they worked together very closely. But since there was only one instrument till 63, I guess, the 300, until the 300 foot came along, since that was the only instrument, most of the work had to be done. And the receivers, again, of course, there were no commercial receivers, and the ones which were supplied by commercial firms were not very reliable, and there was, extreme difficulty in getting good electronic staff. Hein Vadham joined about the same time. He was the first one, and it was the instrumentation problems were mostly of instrumentation and morale in that sense. And the 140 foot, even though the hole had been dug many years earlier, it was a very dispiriting affair because there was very little progress, and again decisions were being made on the structure with very little consultation of the scientific staff.
What about the relationship between NRAO and the university radio astronomers? I've heard that there...
Well, there was quite a bit of friction in the early days because that was a period when many university astronomy, radio astronomy groups were getting funded fairly substantially compared to NRAO, and they didn't accept the idea that they should give up their programs in favor of a national setup. I mean, the concept of a national observatory just did not exist, or national center for anything did not exist. And the idea from the physicists like Brookhaven, that had not peeped into the astronomy groups yet.
That's what AUI
set up. Yeah, I mean, AUI, in principle, they did not see any difficulty of operating a national facility. I mean, they had university groups coming and using their facilities. But astronomers had not done that. Particularly radio astronomy groups were being funded fairly substantially in those days by as substantially as NRAO, except for the capital expenditure at NRAO, I mean, buying up land and buildings and all that, which involved a lot more money than the university facilities.
What percentage of visitors came?
Very few visitors in the early days. Very, very few visitors. I mean, because most of the prospective visitors had instrumentation, comparable instrumentation at their own places. I mean, Michigan, the Caltech had the interferometer going by that time.
Ohio State,
and Harvard had the
NRL.
So they all had comparable instrumentation. Right.
So it's really only when the 300 foot came that you began to get visitors, I guess.
Yes, basically, yes. Only and that 3.75 centimeter receiver in the initial days was a rather substantially improvement over whatever existed elsewhere, even though Fred Haddock also got a similar receiver soon afterwards. And that was built by the Even Knight Corporation. And it was, I mean, for by the standards of that day, it was a pretty good receiver. It had a dialing wave tube front end, so it had a high sensitivity, broad bandwidth.
Okay, well, I'm ending the history about 65 because it just gets too too complex after that. But I would be interested in what you could tell me about the beginnings of radio astronomy in India, even though you may not have personally been involved in that. I don't know.
Well, indirectly, I have been involved in it. Well, see, by chance, it so happened that a number of Indians got into radio astronomy fairly early in the game. I mean, as I said, in 1952, when I came to Harvard, I could have gone to Australia to work in radio astronomy.
Right.
But instead of me, Swaroop and Parthasarathy went to Australia. And Das Gupta was working at that time in Jodrell Bank in Manchester at that time. And little later, early, I think 54 or so, Kundu went to France. And so several of us,
Radhakrishnan,
well, in Sweden, he was in Sweden.
Right.
So several of us by chance got into radio astronomy. So we used to occasionally, whenever we met, we used to talk about the possibility of having a national facility in India if all of us could get together. But it didn't proceed very far until 1961, IAU, at Berkeley IAU. Several of us happened to be there, and one day in the dormitory room we were staying, discussed the possibility, and we drafted a possible plan of action, saying that we will say that we would like to do such and such experimental setup, and write to possible agencies in Government of India asking whether any facility would be, support would be available.
What was the setup that you wanted?
Well, we wanted all of us to be in the same organization. And we wanted, basically, we wanted a low frequency, large surface area instrument. We had not decided as to the exact type of instrument. But we decided we cannot compete in the high frequency with the more advanced countries. But in the lower frequencies, we can. And in terms of construction costs would be lower, surface accuracies would be lower. So we can also compete in terms of large surface area at the lower frequencies. So that was the general concept. And so we wrote it up as a proposal. It's not much more definite than this, but giving a, the reasons why.
A prospectus.
Prospectus. And we sent it to three different people, three different persons concerned with research in India, scientific research in India. And one of them was the then chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, who's a theoretical physicist, who was also the director of the Data Institute of Fundamental Research, who was doing a lot of work. I mean, in, the Data Institute was doing a lot of work in cosmic rays.
What was his name?
Baba. Baba. And of course, cosmic ray people had a lot of interest in radio astronomy. And we, I knew personally many of them, they were my old classmates of mine. So we wrote to Baba, and Baba was known to be a very dynamic leader. I was at Greenbank at that time. So Baba sent me a cable from Vienna within a week of, I sent the, this thing, asked me to meet him in Washington. The week after, he was coming for some meeting. So I went and saw him. He asked for details of all sorts of things about the lab space and this and that, and he said, all right, I agree. But I didn't go until much, much later.
But this is how the Tata Institute got into radio astronomy.
Yes.
The Institute was there before.
Oh, Institute was there long before.
Yeah,
it's, it's a very large institute where they were doing a lot of work in physics of various sorts, I mean, cosmic rays, and particle physics of various sorts.
And who were the radio astronomers that got it going?
Initially, when we when it was first started, three of us were supposed to go. Kundu, Swaroop and myself. We accepted the offer Baba made, the positions and all that. But then I just then got married in the States. So there was a personal reason I decided that I would stay a little longer. And Swaroop went. He had just finished his thesis at Stanford, and he decided he would go. And I agreed with Dr. Baba that I would visit there every year to and help in whatever way I can. So in 63, Swaroop went, and Kundu went later in 63. and so they were the ones who got it started. But I, since I was here, and initially there was some need for some foreign exchange to buy some computer hardware and things like that. Being here, it helped a great deal because NSF organization was much simpler in those days, and the Radio Astronomy Committee were all known radio astronomers. They very sympathetically viewed this request.
I see.
And the amounts involved were not very large, and things could get through very quickly. And that way I helped from this side. And then, of course, the detailed design of the dish.
And it says the OT
yes,
dish
yes.
was the first thing. That was, okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, that ends the interview with Cauchy Menon in Charlottesville on 19th March 75.